claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
I'm just trying to get him right away. Okay, we are live. This is Jim Petzer, your host on The Real, The Raw Deal. And I have several notes to make about what's going on here. This is Jim Petzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I have a terrific guest for you today, but before I turn to what he has to say, which is you're going to find extremely important, extremely valuable and insightful. Let me mention how Biden continues to muck things up. We have, of course, these protesters going to the homes of the justices of the Supreme Court in an effort to change their minds about what's how they're planning to vote to defeat Roe v. Wade. But the fact of the matter is what they're doing is illegal. That the Department of Justice went all whole hog about getting the protesters at the Capitol on January 6th arrested, indicted. They've been held many in solitary confinement for well over a year. The whole situation is completely outrageous. But they're not raising their least digit to do anything about the protesters at the homes of the justices of the court. And yet it's a federal law to make those kinds of protests. It's a federal law. It's a violation. It's a felony. The protests at the Capitol were minor by comparison. They only qualified as misdemeanors for the most part. But Merrick Garland isn't doing a thing. The Biden administration isn't condemning. If you thought we had a president who was representing all the people, it's obviously not the case. Here's a second. This is equally stunning. The Biden administration has canceled permits or requests to lease oil drilling sites in Alaska on the grounds of a lack of interest. Can you imagine when oil is rising to an all-time high per barrel that the Biden administration is claiming that there's no interest in leasing these sites for drilling in Alaska? I mean, give me a break. It was bad enough when he came in and canceled the XL pipeline right off the bat and revoked the permits for drilling on federal land. But now he's going further. I mean, if you wanted a case for dementia in the White House, for irrational decisions, for betraying his duty, his obligations in office to stand up for America, here you have a perfect illustration. In the third place, all the sanctions on Russia that were supposed to harm Russia so badly, well, guess what? The ruble is the best currency, the strongest currency in the world today. The ruble, not the American dollar. The American dollar is fading fast. In fact, the result of all of this intervention in Ukraine is going to be pretty much the opposite of what Biden would like us to believe, because it's not going to harm Russia. It's going to do tremendous damage to the United States. Moreover, the Russian military machine continues to grind down the Ukrainian army. We're not being told. We're only getting propaganda 24/7 about every one of the issues I just mentioned and much, much more. Well, yesterday, it was my great pleasure to meet for the first time a Canadian historian and author who, in my opinion, has one of the best grasps of the big picture of anyone I've ever encountered, and I've encountered quite a few. So I'm going to tell you, this guy is really good. His name is Matt Arrett, and he's got a lot to say. I was especially intrigued when we did a discussion yesterday, which is now posted at my BitChute channel, Jim Petzer, about a forthcoming TNT radio show tomorrow where Matt will be a participant. This was a conversation between Joe Olson, Matt, and myself when we began to talk about, you know, the attempts of the new world, the one world government, the new world order, the great reset that Matt began to explain how this is hardly the first time historically that such efforts have taken place, and that while they were very energetic, they were nevertheless unsuccessful. And that gave me the thinnest ray of hope. Maybe they won't be successful this time either. So I immediately took the opportunity to bring him on today, having only met yesterday. But I can tell you, this guy is good. He has a first-class mind. He has vast knowledge, even encyclopedic. I'm just thrilled to have him here. Matt, welcome to The Raw Deal.
Jim, it's a real pleasure to join you again, and thank you for the generous introduction. Hopefully this conversation, I'm sure it's going to be fun. I hope people learn something out of it and maybe get some hope as well. I think it's very important to not fall prey to the trappings of the wannabe gods of Olympus. Because, I mean, if you think about the way that the oligarchy, and I don't just mean the oligarchy today, but I mean historically as far as a continuous process, the system of oligarchy, right, the right of a few, a hereditary minority to pass on their rights to control the masses of slaves in society, that institution which has been there since the days of ancient Babylon. If you get into the mindset of how these wannabe gods, what is their psychological mind space, right, that shapes their heart, their identity, that they pass on through their own perverted educational process, cultural practices into their kids, grandkids, it's sick, but it's worth getting into that headspace, because they do think of themselves as, or they want their victims to think of them as these mortal gods, these elites above mortals, right, who have this great omnipotent, omniscient power of seeing all, of having the power to do all. And just that thought is enough to make us psychologically, psycho-spiritually impotent sometimes, because we're like, oh, everything we're doing is being watched. Anything we try to do is going to be destroyed. Anybody who's tried to do anything good has been killed, right? And people then take the wrong lessons when they look at the lives of Martin Luther King Jr. or John F. Kennedy or, Lincoln. Like, just look at all of the martyrs who actually lived their lives and fought against this machine and were killed. And the lesson that people then take who have been abused psychologically, the lesson they take is, well, better not to make waves, right? The lesson is, don't try to do anything that's going to challenge the status quo or the powers that be. And the reality is, no, I mean, when you look at history in a sober context, number one, I find a miracle that we've even been able to achieve the level of, I could say it could have been a lot better. Right, I can imagine a world which is better than ours. I think everyone can. But certainly it could have been a lot worse, right? Like, it's a miracle that we broke out of feudalism, that we're, right, like, we're 95% of the population had no literacy and a life expectancy of maybe 28 years of age with infant mortality rates that were like, you know, 3 out of 5 kids dead before 2. And that was like the norm. That was what hundreds of years of what most people had to live in. Where you were like a talking cow on a feudal lord's estate. So it's like, how the hell did we break out of that? Is it that the oligarchy just gave us, right? They were just like, we're so bored in our castles. Let's give them some progress, right? Let's give them some literacy. Let's teach the orphans because we're bored. No, it was a fight, right? Like, it was obviously a fight. The whole American Revolution was a fight. Everything was a fight, for the emancipation of humankind. And so when you start looking at it from that standpoint, that approach to history, I found to be a very valuable approach. And you start seeing that there's weaknesses in this oligarchy's, system and the way that they think. There are Achilles heels. And it reminded me, just when I was listening to what you were saying in the opening remarks, about our own incompetence of the Biden policy at a time of complete self-decapitating energy crisis, economic crisis, that's all being self-induced. This is self-mutilation we're doing to ourselves nominally to try to hurt Russia. And Russia is getting hurt a little bit, but not very much compared to the type of damage we're doing to ourselves. It's really, in my mind, it's kind of like Rumpelstiltskin. I see it as, you remember the story of Rumpelstiltskin?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like that. I think that that's kind of a microcosm of what's going on elegantly. Where to the degree that everybody plays by this demonic little elf's game, everything's okay, you know? you're screwed. But I mean, things are going to just kind of go their pace. But as soon as the victim, I forgot her name, the princess who was assigned by him to by the demonic elf to weave hay into gold infinitely, which already just disobeys the laws of physics and common sense. But anyway, that's what she's doing. And you know, she doesn't want to give up her baby. She's had to do this as part of a pact to save her dad from death by a greedy king who just wanted a lot of gold. And so she agreed to this. The demonic elf gets her out of trouble and on the condition that she gives her firstborn kid to the elf to do with, we can only imagine. But as soon as she guesses his name, because he says, you know, you can break the contract. All you got to do is guess my name. And she's like, okay, Dumbledore? She's like, nope. It's like, Bill? Nope. Okay, you got a third chance, and then if you screw that one up, you're fried. And she finds a way to get the right answer, and Rumpelstiltskin. And he's like, what? In rage, all he can do at this point is tear himself to shreds. and I think, you know, certain powers that be on this earth today, certain statesmen, have decided that they don't want to sacrifice their ancient civilizational forces, their ancient cultures onto this altar that they were expected to sacrifice onto years and years ago. And I think with Russia especially, we've seen a combat, especially since 1999, against the fifth column deep state operations embedded within Russia that were really amplified in the 90s. And there's been an ongoing combat, sometimes the nationalist forces win. Sometimes they lose a battle. But it's been a progressive 25 or 23-year struggle, which has seen a lot of the worst evil satanic oligarchs that have been embedded in Russia, who have escaped jail to find sanctuary in you know, London, where you have the Moscow on the Thames, right? The London oligarch section, or Florida or New York, where a lot of these venomous satanic, you know, officials, billionaires have found home now for about, you know, 20 years. Some of them have gone to jail who remained behind in Russia. But there's been a fight, and Russia is, I think, very clearly, along with other Eurasian powers, no longer willing to go with the New World Order agenda. They're not willing to sacrifice their, like I said, their people, their cultures to this depopulation agenda. And so, they've called out the name. And I think to that degree, The beast, this thing that's controlling this technotronic priesthood, which is controlling their puppets inside the U.S. White House, and also Canada and much of Europe, they can only rage. They don't know how to actually deal with the reality that you have real, you know, competent, creative battling happening right now on a multitude of levels. And so they're doubling down. They've been committed to depopulation for a long time. So right now you've got a shutdown of what little productive powers we still had available to us. We're seeing that was already atrophying for like 50 years. And now in the last, you know, especially couple of months, they're just doubling down, destroying food crops, killing 37 million chickens and turkeys, canceling pipelines, canceling vital energy resources, and just utilizing what little energy we had in reserves. They're just, you know, pumping it out, so we don't really even have much as far as reserves are concerned in Canada either. So yeah, it's psychopathic, but it's a Rumpelstiltskin complex as far as I see it.
Well, Matt, I really so appreciated yesterday when you began talking about how there have been these efforts to impose one world government. I'd really like for us to recap part of that in as much detail and as great extent as you would like to go. This is all your time. I'm so eager to have you present all your background and knowledge to my audience. I'm just delighted you're here. Go for it.
Jim, all right. Well, you give me carte blanche here. That's okay, cool. How can I ask you this? How are we doing, 1 hour or are we doing 2 hours?
2 hours.
Okay, if you give me free rein, all right, I'll paint a little picture, I guess. All right, so from my research, and a lot of this can be found for people who are unsatisfied by just the spoken word, because we're going to summarize a lot. There's going to be a lot of thumbnail sketches going around. You know, I'm going to be hopping around, but I'm going to still try to keep it coherent and principled. But for those who are not satisfied by that, they can read more extensively this research in the context of my three new books. I've recently published a trilogy called The Clash of the Two Americas with my wife, Cynthia Chung, who's also a wonderful author, with me in strategic culture. And so the purpose of the Clash of the Two Americas is to reconstruct American history. And this is ironic that I'm a Canadian doing this, but maybe it had to be that way for the time being. I don't know. But to reconstruct American history from the standpoint that there is that the American Revolution of 1776 to 83, when the Peace of Paris was in 1783, was an unresolved battle. It was a battle won.
Steve, I'm on.
It was good that battle was won. Something new was created for human society to work with, as far as a new type of system of natural law governed by the consent of the governed, the idea that all men and women are created equal, made in the image of God, with thus inalienable rights that endow us with the idea that, for example, your rights to life, liberty, happiness were not something that could be given by a human being or thus taken away, but were intrinsic to our common equal birth as far as being made as creatures in the image of God, and that the nation's laws are contingent upon the general welfare, to the degree that the nation's economic, political, security policies are in coherence with things that defend and improve upon the general welfare. That's the degree to which they're good. They're in conformity with natural law, right? The laws of the universe that were there even before the American Revolution. Or before human beings arose, there were still these natural laws of the universe made by the lawmaker, the creator. So that concept philosophically is super rich. And as a Canadian, I was treated in my schooling experience to not respect that because we're British. English speaking Canadians might sound or look a lot like our American cousins, but the reality that we're taught early on is that we're superior in many ways because we never had to go through a bloody revolution, right? We never had to do that. We just knew that if we were obedient and if we were patient, that the sometimes overbearing mother country would grant us those liberties, which ultimately she did grant us, right? And the crown gave us these liberties, which are enshrined in our founding documents. But if you read our founding documents, they're a failure, morally and psychologically and philosophically failures, because it literally says in the 1867 British North America Act that it's not like we're a nation that was set up to promote the interests of the people or the general welfare. It literally says in order to promote the interests of the British Empire. That's why we were set up constitutionally. With a privy council, a governor general, a deep state structure embedded, enshrined in our government. And the democratic component is sort of a secondary feature. So we missed out. We had an opportunity. We had many opportunities to recapture the failure to accept Ben Franklin's offer and his challenge to the early, Quebecois, the French Canadians, to join and become the 14th member of the 13 colonies to declare this new nation together. And again, the break in history is so big because before this, all that we had was hereditary power, right? Might makes right. Your bloodline determines your destiny, whether you were born poor or whether you were born into a hereditary blue blood family. That would, you had no free will to change your destiny. And that was the norm. Like I said, feudalism, right? That was part of the formula for that disaster, but it goes back for a very long time. So it was a major, major new potential for human beings as a whole, not just in America, but globally, to operate under a completely higher paradigm. But it was sabotaged. And so the point in my book series is that the culmination, the fruition of this new age of reason, which was supposed to happen, was derailed. First in France with the, people I think are generally aware that there was a something that was trying to act in accordance with the American principles in France in 1789 and 90 and 91 and 92. That turned into a bloody Jacobin terror, a bloodbath where, in a very short period of time, the qualified leadership of France, who had done so much to just a few years earlier help the U.S. cause against the British, the qualified leaders, people who were like the greatest scientists, like Antoine Lavoisier, a close collaborator of Ben Franklin, who was the ambassador to France, right, through a very important period. Jean-Sylvain Bailly, the mayor of Paris, who was also the head of the Assemblée Nationale, who led the tennis court oath in 1789. Marquis de Lafayette, obviously, but many others. What happened was, what began as a hopeful replication of the success of the U.S. experience quickly turned into everybody losing their heads. Bad corrupt people who were part of the elites lost their heads. Good people who were not corrupt, who were part of the so-called elites, lost their heads. And everybody, the population who were abused, they suffered a lot. The population of peasants, right? It was a seigneurie, a feudal system of France. So the people didn't have the sort of cognitive powers that the American, average American farmer had in America, which, you know, you had the idea that there was a culture of literacy by the time of the American Revolution. So everybody could read if you were a farmer. You could read the Bible in Latin, in Greek. There was a much wider cultural power in the Americas. So people could read Thomas Paine and understand, well, okay, why is it worth risking my life for the cause of freedom? A very abstract idea. That wasn't easy for the Quebecois, uneducated farmers, to understand. They couldn't read pamphlets. Same thing for the French in France. The population, they couldn't read most of the pamphlets. So most people, they were really operating on despair, pain, hunger. And that type of population was weaponizable. So what we had was sort of the proto-color revolution. We've seen this technique refined over the years. We've seen it refined in the Bolshevik Revolution, right, where an abused poor people are corralled and utilized as weapons, mobs, to destroy all institutions, good and bad alike, right, on behalf of those who are managing the strings from the top, who want to destroy nation states and destabilize them. And we've seen this more aggressively, especially in the age of George Soros, Mark Malik Brown, starting in the 80s with the Open Society, the National Endowment for Democracy, that sort of took this that was already done in the French Revolution and just refined it with modern techniques using social media and stuff. But the same thing, ultimately, to overthrow, whether it was, you know, the Philippines in the 80s under Marcos, or we saw this replicated again in Georgia in 2003, and Ukraine twice. I mean, a variety of places this has been used to destructive ends. But it's always been an imperial weapon. So it failed in France. And as soon as it failed in France, you had just, you know, like 5 years of civil war on top of external wars. It was a mess. And a lot of this was being funded by British intelligence. So people like Jeremy Bentham had a handle and had certain key people, including Robespierre, Danton, Marat, operating on a very close leash for British intelligence, as far as like rabble rousers who were able to then just direct the mob. So that didn't go well. And after the king and the various elites were all killed, there was a vacuum of power. And filling the vacuum, none other than a man who promised to restore order was brought into play. And I think we all know the story of Napoleon, who promised to be a Roman consul from the Roman, echoing the time of the Roman Republic. But soon, quickly, people realized, no, it's not the Roman consul, it's not the Roman Republic, that's his model, actually. He declared himself emperor. And it's actually the Roman emperor or empire that was his model. And that became 20 years of religious wars in Europe. Often, if you look again, and I know you've talked about this, Jim, I've looked at some of your archives, the Rothschilds, you know, leading banking networks in the city of London, were more than happy to fund both the British as well as the French armies in this ongoing war of chaos. And so all of the Republican movements in Prussia, in Ireland, in Poland, in Spain, under the Goya networks, and King Carlos, who was a good Republican king, ironically, in Spain at that time. All of these more positive networks were ripe and ready to move to usher in this new age of reason and brotherhood and you know, this Republican set of values. Not George Bush Republican, obviously. I'm talking about the higher philosophical idea, right? That was all crushed in 20 years of ongoing war. So that derailed. But it was a wake-up call for the British Empire that and the oligarchy as a whole, because it wasn't just the British Empire. If you look at the ruling families of Britain, they're, you know, these were the Hanoverian families, the you know, later on the Saxe-Coburg, the Goethe families, the German families were the ruling families that later changed their name to Windsor. there's a lot of interbreeding. A lot of this even goes, there's overlap with the Habsburg families, with the, so the ruling aristocratic old nobility are inbred. They utilized, their localized empires in Europe to fight each other for territorial gains, over a long time. But overall, they were united in a common sense of self-interest. So they worked together and they reestablished themselves after the fall of Napoleon in 1815. And this is a very important moment, right? Because what happens in 1815? This is the moment that Henry Kissinger writes his first book in, I think it's 1959. And it's on, Metternich and Castlereagh's Congress of Vienna. Now, Kissinger in his book, when he's still, you know, just a young, you know, upstart sociopath, just being introduced to the Council on Foreign Relations, he talks about this 1815 Congress of Vienna as the most important master key in world history. He says this is the most important thing that ever happened in history, which is his lifelong model of how to navigate real politics. What everything he does is informed by the experience that he studied in this book, which was, I think, his PhD thesis. So what was this Congress of Vienna? Is it something you've heard about?
Go for it.
Okay.
This is terrific.
So the Congress of Vienna was the restoration of the monarchies. So in Europe, as soon as the Battle of Waterloo was ended, you had British intelligence in the form of a figure named Lord Castlereagh, who was a leading grand strategist of those days, who with his collaborator, Prince Metternich, was another leading organizer of this, arranged a large, long, booze-filled, orgiastic conference that went on for several months. The Congress of Vienna was the name. And and essentially what was agreed upon was the need to consolidate power to ensure that on a political, a cultural, an educational level, that the ideas that gave birth to the chaos of the French Revolution and then Napoleon would never be permitted to blossom ever again in Europe. This is a moment when the Jesuit order was reestablished because, you know, they had been banned, right? The Jesuits were a part of this thing. They had been banned in 1773 from Europe by a pope who very soon found himself poisoned to death. Probably not a coincidence. And they had to go, they reestablished for about 45 years their home base in Moscow. And the Jesuits were not really allowed to operate openly anywhere in Europe for that entire period until the 1815 Congress of Vienna. Then they were reconstituted. They were granted all authorization to reestablish their power as a sort of a secret police of the Vatican that wasn't just designed to protect the Vatican. It was actually also designed to keep the Vatican in check. So it was kind of like a deep state operation, right? That had a very Masonic sort of structure of control, especially with the higher degrees. So it was a very, very useful tool of control that could take chameleon-like, techniques to masquerade as anything in order to advance a certain way of thinking about theology and the way the world should be governed. So that was reestablished. Russia was, you know, under that time, the Jesuit influenced Russia, which still had good people. Don't get me wrong. There were still good patriots fighting against this, but that component, the deep state component of it, became the police officer of much of Europe during this period. And most importantly, there was something called the Carlsbad Decrees around the same time that the Congress instituted, which was a massive Orwellian system of controls of acceptable thought, acceptable art, acceptable books. And you had censors in every publishing house. You had censors in schools. You had a mass purging of all teachers who encouraged their students to read Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Paine or even listen to Beethoven. It was almost impossible to listen to even the works of a lot of the more what you might consider, you know, Promethean musicians who, when you really listen to some of this great music, you change in a more powerful way, right? And this was all recognized as being not compatible with the type of system of cultural and sociological controls that an oligarchy required to maintain human talking cows. So, you know, again, you couldn't find books. It was like a big book purge. A lot of teachers flooded into the United States from Germany, from Europe at this time, especially Germany. the first wave their careers were crushed. Kind of like McCarthyism. It was kind of like McCarthyism, right? If you said something good about, or let's say you brought up in the 1950s, right? If you brought up something about the Wall Street funding of fascism and you were a teacher or you were working with a security clearance, forget about it. You were like a red commie agent to be purged by the FBI. That's kind of like what it was. So that was sort of the basis of the idea of a global system of stability. And under the Congress, and what Kissinger writes in his treaties, is that the greatest good, this is where you get them, or this is where they're you see the biggest fallacy of the system of empire. The greatest good is the greatest static stability. And because the Congress of Vienna achieved the greatest consolidation of power into the master class and achieved a culture of stasis that crushed creative thought, that crushed the heart's ability to love freedom, they did it quite effectively. He says that is the basis upon which the New World Order that he devotes his life to, right, in the Cold War and even to this very day, somehow he's still alive, is all premised on this formula, right? The greatest good is the greatest no change. Now, that's not actually true, right? every piece of evidence we could find from the universe, from the living universe, the process of life evolving, and before life appeared on the earth, we see the growth of suns. Suns come out of, apparently from processes we don't even understand, from galaxies. Galaxies are producing suns. We got things most of what the universe is made of, to be perfectly honest, we don't know. We haven't discovered. We're given a lot of definitive textbooks that tell us that, oh yeah, everything has been discovered. And people write about dark matter and dark energy and black holes, and it goes on forever about all of these things. We know exactly what's inside the sun. Look, we've got pictures of the cutout of the sun, and you're like, wait a minute, we don't know any of this stuff. Nothing's been proven. This is just conditioning, and it creates arrogance and a lack of humility, because now all of a sudden, if we think we know it all, what's going to motivate minds to come to try to discover anything if it's all this, been charted down to the 13.7 decimal point, right? They could chart down apparently mathematically exactly when the Big Bang happened to the split second. And it's like, my God, the arrogance of it all. We just discovered there was such a thing as atomic behavior a little over a century ago. And now you're going to say you know about when the universe began and when it's going to end. Come on. So all that to say, the Congress of Vienna was a big, big disastrous thing, but it was so, and I'm getting at this to get at the question of the New World Order sabotages, right? Because the thing about this is that it was so destructive on a spiritual level to the majority of the people living in Europe, especially at that time. America was far enough removed. The Americans were smart enough to not get enmeshed in that during this period. So they had their own experience outside of it, but it's important to just put yourself in the traumatized state of an average person living through this in Europe. There was such a stifling experience that, and also economically, there was people were being crushed, kind of like what they've done to Mexico since the 80s, right, or Russia in the 90s. They wanted to economically punish the European peasants and people for wanting a better life for themselves and being belligerent to their overlords. So they economically punished them massively by inducing increased rates of starvation. The Malthusian laws of population control were put into force. We saw in Ireland, right, the Irish potato famine was an artificial killing off of millions of Irish under a controlled starvation policy. It's not like they didn't have enough food. It's kind of like today's America, right? It's not like there wasn't enough food in Ireland to feed all their people. It's that the British free trade gunboats said, no, your free trade agreement with us demands that you export that and keep your borders open and not feed your local people. And we're gonna have soldiers on the ground to shoot anybody trying to eat their crops. And that was literally Ireland lost half its population. It was a disaster, but it was a controlled disaster. And they did the same thing in India as well and other parts of Europe. So with all of this bubbling rage by the people who had been abused, one of the ideas that there's another danger of revolutionary activity occurring again. That's what happens, right? When you put tyranny on, you're always going to welcome obviously pushback. You know, people will want, will always fight for freedom generally, unless they're really beaten down. So we had a moment when Marquis de Lafayette, at his very old age, in 1830, had a second chance. And that second chance, there was a lot of people in, from the U.S. side as well, working with Marquis de Lafayette. You know, keep in mind, Marquis de Lafayette was in America from 1824-25, working and mobilizing with people like John Quincy Adams, who was very closely aligned to the Republican networks of Europe. People like James Fenimore Cooper, Edgar Allan Poe even, were part of the intelligence apparatus, the Republican intelligence networks that were working with Marquis de Lafayette, and who were found, who were in France during 1830s. Samuel B. Morse, the great inventor and discoverer, he was the ambassador to, he was there on the ground in France too. You had many other people, but point is, the idea was, okay, France now has a second chance in 1830 to have their Republican Revolution. Marquis de Lafayette is the man who can be president. He's the only one qualified to do it, and he screws up again. He's the only one who didn't lose his head, because he ended up escaping France back in 1791 or 92, and he ended up in a jail, in a dungeon in some Austrian, you know, oligarch's castle for about 5 years as punishment. But anyway, he still had he was like a hero. He was the hero of the American Revolution. And he was the hero of Canada, too. You know, he was organizing with Papineau, the man who went on to lead the rebellion of Lower Canada in Quebec in 1837. He was meeting with him. He was meeting with William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was the Republican leader of the rebellion against the British in Canada and today's Ontario. They were meeting. So there was an international array of players who were organizing for a long time to undo the Congress of Vienna, the cultural dictatorship, and everything else, with a new attempt to restore, to create, or undo the mistake of 1789. And it failed again. After all of these years of effort, it failed again. And Marquis de Lafayette made a bad mistake. He thought he could work with the new king. I think it was Charles X. And he basically made him, or no, it was Louis Égalité's son. Forgot his name. And he basically went in front of the mobs of hundreds of thousands of French who were ready to declare themselves free and independent as a sovereign republic. And he went onto the stage, onto the balcony with the wannabe king and said, okay, I will be in charge of the military and I'll maintain security and I support this guy becoming the king. And he was an idiot. He thought he could trust the king. Within weeks, he was fired from all positions of authority. He was stripped of all honors. And the king restored a hardcore dictatorship onto the people of France. And the empire, the oligarchy, only grew and grew and grew. So what happened as a response was, okay, Lord Palmerston and another Freemasonic psychopath named Giuseppe Mazzini, who you might have heard of. He was the guy who was a controller, a handler of a fellow named Albert Pike in the United States. They came up with a new way of channeling this revolutionary energy into chaos and anarchism, and it became the growth of what was called the Young Europe Movement. So Mazzini and Palmerston created a new type of movement called the Young Europe Movement, of young people, didn't have experience of the past, they were very abused, very, very, they had economic despair, no hope for the future, and so they became parts of this new type of, it became cool to be a young Polish, a young German, a young Canadian. And in America, you had branches in the North, Young America movements under a certain character who was trained under Thomas Carlyle, who was in charge of cultural warfare in the British Empire. And his name was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he created a pamphlet called the Young America pamphlet to shed off the old traditions of the belief in the Constitution, which is a document of hypocrisy that should never have existed. And he calls for essentially a hyper-atomized new type of man amongst the young who shouldn't trust anybody over 30. and this new movement, which again is directed by Thomas Carlyle and many others from British intelligence in Europe, creates one branch of the Young America movement, which Edgar Allan Poe is doing battle with. If you look at Edgar Allan Poe's writings throughout the entire 1830s and all the way up until his assassination, he's doing battle with this transcendentalist new culture in his How to Write a Blackwoods article and other things. He's always doing battle with this thing because he sees it as an intelligence operation to weaken and undermine the U.S. culturally from within. The other branch of the Young America movement takes place in the South, and with CP's course, his agent in the United States, well, there's two big ones. One of whom is Albert Pike, who goes on to become the founder of modern Scottish Rite Freemasonry. He's a Confederate general. He's also working closely with this other guy named George Saunders. I don't think it's related to Colonel Saunders, but he is a colonel. and he's managing the Confederate basing of intelligence operations in Canada. So during the entire Civil War, people often, this has been almost written out of most history books, but a big thing that Lincoln was having to deal with was not only the secessionist movement in the South defending the slave power, but also the fact that he had this British operation in the North, British Canada, which had provided vast intelligence operations. I mean, Toronto, Montreal, and Halifax were the three biggest zones of Confederate spies. George Saunders, who was a high official in Franklin Pierce's government. So Franklin Pierce was sort of like a Mazzini government, it was a Young America government with, all of those people who went on to craft the Confederate Constitution that enshrined slavery as an unbreakable component in Article 1 of the Confederate Constitution, right? It actually has, there shall be no laws that ever allow for the freeing of any slaves forever as part of Article 1 of the Confederate Constitution. And people say, oh yeah, if there was no Civil War, slavery would have just disappeared naturally. It's like, it's in the damn Constitution. So all that to say, George Saunders is a guy who had, under Franklin Pierce's time in the 1850s, he had spent a lot of time with Mazzini in Europe. He ran an anarchist network. He interfaced closely with what became the Emma Goldman networks that killed later on McKinley. And this is what people like John Wilkes Booth were brought into. When John Wilkes Booth was up in Montreal for 4 weeks in October and November of 1864, which is where he got his payment, his program, his marching orders when he was deployed back to the U.S. And there's letters of Wilkes Booth, people who deny what I'm saying. There's letters that are available archivally of him talking with one of his relatives saying, yeah, this is an amazing experience. I'm losing track of time. I don't even know if I've been here for 5 weeks or 7 weeks. And it's like there was something weird psychologically going on in his, in his world. Anyway, George Saunders was the other one, who was a high-level official in the Confederate government. So that was this whole idea of creating, weaponizing the masses is what people like. In my research, I've seen increasingly that Engels and Marx were part of this Dritsippi young Europe movement, and they just sort of took a lot of the theories of economics that had been advanced by people like Jeremy Bentham, especially David Ricardo, who's a British imperial economist. A lot of garbage in his thinking, but it was very influential. And Marx basically says in his theory of how human societies evolved and what should be the final destination of humankind into this utopic communist, state after the previous states had gone through their natural cyclical class revolution, So Marx was taking all of Ricardo's theories about the law of exploitation, the law of diminishing returns, and saying, okay, that right there is not what happens when you screw up or you act in folly. He said that this is the fraud of Marx. He said that is an immutable law of nature, that there will always be, as you have progress, an abundance of capital that accumulates into fewer hands, causing a tension, an exploitation of greater amounts of people. And even David Ricardo, before Marx had even said this, David Ricardo just thought it was, he had a different way of resolving it. And Marx said, okay, this point of collapse will result in a regime change in a class of struggle that will overthrow the old order and create a new order. And there's four phases in total, as he said, to all of human experience, with the final phase, the last phase, being communism, the abolishment of private property, and the equalization of everybody on a mathematical playing field. Now, all this was, if you actually look at the effects of this in the Paris Commune in 1871 and other things, everything I'm looking right now is just showcasing to me that they just took the Young Europe formula and made it a little bit more scientifically coherent to make it more controllable and deployable as a battering ram to undo nations that were acting in accordance with their general welfare of their own people. And we saw it deployed. Everybody who was killed, every statesman who was doing something good from the 1860s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way till the Archduke Ferdinand, and even the killing of many German leaders in the 1820s and 30s, the vast majority, I'd say like 98%, were killed by anarchist cells that were ideological little zombies deployed by Anglo-American or mostly Anglo-intelligence operations to do things that the people who were shooting were just disposable little things. They were ideologically, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know who was controlling them. They had romantic ideas, right, by reading Marx's Capital of what they were going to get as this great utopia. They had no idea. But they were also, they had suffered a lot. They'd suffered a lot of abuse. So anyway, this was done. And we saw how it was deployed to destroy Russia when Russia, after Russia had saved the USA during the Civil War, right, by deploying the Russian Navy under Alexander II to the coasts of the Atlantic and Pacific. We saw how that turned the tides in favor of the Union, because the message was, and Alexander II gave an interview that was published by Warren Barker, a banker, who was not a bad banker, in the 1890s. That was when it was published. But he basically said, you know, the reason for us deploying the battle fleet, and everybody knew this, was it was on request by Lincoln via Cassius Clay, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow. That was what brokered the deal. And it was a direct message to the British and the French imperialists that if you enter openly the war with a hard power, it will be a casus belli against Russia. And so that's what kept these imperial powers who, I mean, there were something like 15,000 British troops in Canada ready to invade from the north. There was something like, I don't know the number, but there were a lot of French troops in Mexico stationed and ready to back up militarily the Confederate South from the north. And the only thing that kept them in Mexico and Canada was the Russian threat in 1863. So you had this complete transformation of potential once more, right? Instead of the divide to conquer breaking up of nation states, you had a unification of the nation, especially under Lincoln's greenbacks, his brilliant banking techniques that unified there were something like 7,000 different local currencies. Just to get that across, right? In 1859, 1860, there was about 7,000 local currencies for 25 years since the Second Bank of the USA was dismantled. Every state, every local bank was granted the authority to issue their own little mini local currencies. There was no coherence. There was economic insanity and constant bank runs, bank panics. It was a speculative frenzy of no development. There was no big infrastructure happening during that time because everything was like canceled to pay the debt in 1836. So everything seized up. The U.S. became an economically really weak place except for the Confederate South. There they exploded because the British were buying 80% of the southern cotton for their textiles. And so the British were very clear that, you know, the South had to win. And that's why the British were making gunboats. They were making warships for the South. They were providing logistics support in Canada as well as having on-the-ground supporters there. They were providing financial support through their banks. And they were trying to choke Lincoln. They were saying to Lincoln, like, hey, okay, we'll give you a loan. If you want to go to a European bank or even a lot of your Wall Street banks, we'll give you a loan, 30% interest. You know, obviously that was not going to be paid. It's not viable. So the greenbacks were done as a way to invoke national banking practices once more for the first time in decades, utilizing Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, right? And that then provided the capital needed through treasury notes, not private finance, to then create a new type of money in circulation that could then provide loans not only to businesses and big infrastructure works, but also to pay for the soldiers who weren't getting paid. And that was vital. Another component of that was the 520 bonds. So the issuance of these bonds that mature in 5 or 20 years that were again part of what allowed the capitalization of the USA and also the creation and coherence of a national policy around the Transcontinental Railway, which also came with that a whole slurry of industrial activity that wouldn't have existed otherwise. So all of this was part of the fight. The Confederate South, they didn't want industrial activity. They didn't like machinery. They liked the idea of human, physical, talking cow labor, which, I mean, one machine can do the work of 1,000 people if you do it well. So that was, it broke the formula of what made their idea of what their wealth was function. So that's why the British were supporting the South on so many levels. And that's why the Russians came in to save them, because what was Alexander II? He was the great liberator. He liberated the serfs, 25 million serfs, in the month before Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. That was when Alexander II liberated all of the serfs. The challenge was the same. How do you then put these people to work? How do you give them a viable purpose to life after they're off the plantations? So this is where you need to have industrial growth. You have to have manufacturing. You have to have an educational program to make this work. And Russia was very much enthusiastic to apply this across Russia. So you had said the Dmitry Mendeleev, right? Everybody knows him as a chemist, a great chemist. He was also a great patriot who was studying in America. He came to the USA in 1876 at the Centennial Exhibition with a whole big Russian delegation. And he went back to Russia, was appointed to become the head of the Protective Tariff Committee of Russia. That's what his job was. And he charted out the need to develop new mines, new rail, new development, new industrial corridors in Europe, working very closely with a network of American collaborators. American engineers were on the ground in Russia helping to build the Trans-Siberian Railway after 1890. The Trans-Siberian was built with rail cars made in Philadelphia, Baldwin locomotives. Who knows that, you know? That's big. That's a big deal. And they were doing that with state banks. So under Sergei Vita and Mendeleev, this dynamic duo, Vita being the finance minister, they managed to create, to consolidate the unpayable debts, and they created a whole network of state banks along the rail lines, especially to fund the development of this thing, but a lot more. And it was moving in a very positive trajectory, especially with the opening up of Siberia, the connection into Manchuria, China. There were rail lines that were even being funded by French and American bankers that were working with the nationalists that wanted to you know, basically do what failed to happen in 1776, which was finally create a world of mature sovereign nation states working on cooperation instead of killing each other. And cooperation, it's always better if you're going to work together rather than go to war with your neighbor. That's a much better way of doing business. So that's what all of this was about. And throughout the 1880s, starting with the murder of Garfield, you had a whole slew of about 32 high level murders. Garfield was murdered the same year that Alexander II was murdered. Again, anarchist bomb. Alexander III, poisoning. You had the French president, Sadi Carnot, was assassinated in France, was developing this American system, Lincoln model policy in France with protectionism, rail development. Bismarck was fired, but many German allies of Bismarck were killed by anarchists in that time in the 1890s as well, because they were all fighting to keep World War I from happening. They were all based upon a policy of diplomacy and cooperation with Russia, with even China and Japan, and keeping these countries out of British manipulative intrigue. Everyone had an understanding that the heart of evil was, and it's not all the British people or the British government, it's this, but this is where the parasite is found. It's the host. It's found in the city of London, and it's in British intelligence that has their ambassadors, their fifth columns everywhere. And so everybody had a much greater understanding of that, and the people who had the best understanding of that were all assassinated. And there's a big list, like I said. the Bolshevik Revolution was soon launched as well, funded by people like Lord Milner, the Jacob Schiff, who was a big financier behind this, as well as the setting up of the Federal Reserve in 1913. Many of the J.P. Morgan complex were involved in this. Many of the City of London financial powers were all involved in funding the worst elements of the Bolsheviks as another battering ram to overthrow the danger of, you know, a U.S.-Russian-German trifecta working together on big infrastructure and science and technology together, right? That was a danger that the British Empire could not survive if that was permitted to blossom. So that had to go. And they kicked over the chessboard. And what we know of is the bloodbath of 4 years of useless, pointless meat grinder. That was World War One. That was the killing of the Romanovs, right? The destruction of that dynamic, the ouster of Vita, the killing of something like 40 different Russian high-level foreign ministers and people who were on Vita's side were all assassinated as part of the chaos complex. But the British, again, the point being here is they got another kick in the ass of reality. They realized that the global empire, there was only one world empire at that time, and it wasn't America. In the 1890s, it was just the sun never sets on the British Empire. And that was obviously dismantling. It was falling apart, right? The British had overextended themselves with the opium wars in China, which was an evil set of wars, right? That was super, super sinful to destroy the Chinese. They overextended. That was very costly, though, to carry out that second opium war. The 2 year combat to destroy the Indian uprisings in 1859-60, also very costly. The earlier Crimean wars to suck Russia into the endless wars in the Balkan area and against the Ottomans. That was a very effective thing too, or cost expensive thing. And then the British efforts to try to split up the USA was very expensive, and everybody got a better sense of the nature of this thing. And so they had to change their ways. And the British, this is what gets us into now the 20th century.
Matt, this is my perfect moment to take a break. And this is just a masterpiece. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have you here. We'll have a break about 4.5 minutes, and then we'll continue with this disquisition that is just a mind-bending. I'm loving it, Matt. This is terrific. I could not ask for more. We'll be back. We'll be back in just a few right after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet?
I hope.
We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. 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 Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome back to the Raw Deal with Matt Arrett. I'm reminded of years ago when I was on with John P. Wells, and he asked me a question about what happened at JFK. And I spoke for three and a half hours. John P. liked it so well, he released it to the public for free. Well, I was doing that without any notes. Matt's doing this without any notes. This guy has a superior mind, and I am just so honored to have him here as my guest. When I encountered him yesterday, I just recognized the quality of this man, his knowledge, his intellect, his articulation. This is one for the book. So, Matt, I'm just delighted. Yes, we can do a screen share. Give me one second. What I will do is make you the host. So you're ready to go. I think you can rock and roll and do what you like here. Go for it.
Okay. I may not use the screen share. I just sometimes, you know, you want to just punctuate something with an image. So
sure.
I'm having the freedom. Thanks. And thank you again, Jim. For those very kind words, probably too generous words, but we try our best, right? I think that's the thing with the example you gave of your experience when your friend asked you something so simple like, "What's the story with JFK?"
Yeah,
you know, it's beyond information. It's something which you understand in your heart as being first of all, it's sacred because the truth is sacred, and you know that everything changed because of that. That lie that's been maintained, and to the degree that the lie is maintained, the great good that could have happened had JFK's momentum, his spirit, his ideas not been sabotaged with his early death, we could be living in a much more beautiful world. Especially imagine 2 terms of that plus another 2 terms of Bobby Kennedy. My God, like just look at their policies, what they envisioned, and it was going to work. And look at who they were scaring, because the power structures of evil were definitely being challenged. And you know, you've immersed yourself in thousands, I'm sure, if not more, hours of research and thinking about the facts. So yeah, I mean, it's just like it's part of you. And so when somebody says, "Hey, just," what's the story of JFK? You could just go on. You probably got to, you could probably marathon that for another 8 hours. I mean, the story as well. I mean, my approach, I got to say, the thing that gave me a lot of inspiration to approach history this way was when I was introduced to the method of thinking and the writings of a recently deceased American economist named Lyndon LaRouche. I don't know if that's a figure you've looked at.
Sure, yes, go for it. Yeah.
I mean,
brilliant, brilliant guy.
Yeah, super. I mean, something else, a real phenomenon. And so, you know, people might agree or disagree with elements, predicates of what he says, but overall, if you look at the methodology of history, and he's very clear on what his method is. So I really recommend people take the time to just sit back, turn off social media, read, you know, a few hours of something dense. You know, he's written things in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. There's pick a thing and just, you know, work it through. And the method is solid. And that is what I've found to be the most valuable method that I've been able to bear, that bore a lot of fruit in my research, which is to look for the tragedy, the classical tragedy of history. So it's to see history not just as a series of events that happen on a timeline, which is the mistake I think of a lot of academics in history. Is they're like, okay, there's no real continuity of history as a whole. There's really just a bunch of dates that you memorize associated with events that happened, and it all is just stuff in the past. It has no real bearing on anything that regards our future or understanding our present circumstances in a meaningful way, at least. And that's a fraud. When you actually look at history as it happened, from the standpoint that there is a battle of ideas, of right ideas and wrong ideas about how the nature of the universe is, what the nature of human beings are, is made in the image of whatever this universe is. If you believe the universe is a cold, dark place that has no regard for morality, you're going to live your life a very different way. You will ignore the calls of your conscience, right? That'll be stifled more and more the more you habituate yourself to that. And if you think of the universe as a universe of law that is imbued with creativity, design, purpose, that we're made in the image of that. That's what we're part of. Like, we're part of the universe. We're not like separate. There's not the universe and then there's us, right? The subjective us and the objective universe are two parts of the same damn thing. So you're going to live your life a very different way. How you think about law, how you think about economic policy, how you think about human nature, everything is, how you think about science is going to be different, right? In one school, science would be something which separates you more from religion or from spirituality, as you learn, you know, that logic allows us to discount the belief in metaphysics or things that are abstract, you know, like pure logic allows us to account for all the formulas that explain the universe. That's one approach. The other one, if you look at people who made discoveries, like great discoveries like Kepler or Da Vinci, or I mean, there's so many. They have a very different view, and in that other world of thinking, science is something which brings us into communion with the Creator. It's something which is sacred. It's not something which disproves morality or anything like that. If anything, it enhances it. So it's like two opposing currents exist for a very long time, masquerading as Western science or Western economics. But they're not the same thing. They're competing. One represents an oligarchical mode of organizing society around a master-slave class, right, where the masters control the shadows, the slaves believe in the shadows, and that's the forever model in the Kissinger static world, right, of the Congress of Vienna. The talking cows know their place. They're happy and satisfied with the scraps we give them, and the elites know their place in their castles, having their orgies. Lording above the mortals and as the gods of Olympus, right? Controlling the shadows. Today it might have a bit of a secular veneer, but when you listen to like Yuval Harari or a lot of the World Economic Forum gurus talking about their philosophy of transhumanism, it's actually what is masquerading as science or secular science, but it's really not. It's really, it's got a form of religious fervor to it, of a satanic quality. So there's that. Anyway, we ended our last segment on the question of the dissolution of the globally extended British Empire in the 1890s, with the spread of this Lincoln American modeled system of political economy in Russia, in France, in Germany. This is what created the Zollverein, for example. The customs union of Germany was this American system that was advanced by a. The actual term American system was popularized by a German, not even an American, named Frederick List, who came to America with Marquis de Lafayette in the 1820s and stayed till throughout the 30s. And he studied how was it that America survived the precarious early 20 years of its existence after the revolution. How was how was the nation united under a common policy? How did the population quadruple its population as well as increase its longevity and its productive powers of labor? So he studied these things. How did Hamilton do that? How is this different from everything that was known in Europe? And he brought that discovery in his books, which are readable today, back to Europe, back to Prussia, to unify the German state from being formerly, which was just, you know, a bunch of warring baronials and princelings, no common unification, no development, very undereducated population. And he unified it under the Zollverein to become one of the most productive, if not the most productive manufacturing zone in a period of like 30 years. It really accelerated under Bismarck. But it wasn't specifically German as a policy. It was ironically quite American. So this was like spreading everywhere. Even in China, you had a Lincoln admiring revolutionary named Sun Yat-sen, who was preparing the 1911 revolution that created a republic for the first time and overthrew the hereditary Manchus. Or the Qing emperor or empress. So that was, again, Sun Yat-sen was studying in the United States in the 1880s and 90s. He brought his discoveries of what Lincoln was doing into the three principles of the people that became the basis upon which China, even today, to this very day, they still celebrate Sun Yat-sen, ironically a Christian, a Confucian Christian studying in the United States who created the Republic, the modern Republic of China, is celebrated with statues as a national hero, ironically both of Taiwan but also of mainland. So it's these rich historical paradoxes. They're so juicy, and so this whole thing was spreading around the world. It was becoming clear that the old system of empire was dissolving. It was not long for this world. This idea that might makes right, that wealth is just based upon extraction or speculation or war, those definitions of wealth, rent. Right? Usury. Those are not viable forms of the definition of wealth. That was not what, that's purely imperial. That's parasite wealth. That's parasite capitalism. So that was finally being overthrown. So what was done, like I said, there was a kicking over of the chessboard, a lot of assassinations, some regime changes, and a war that didn't have to happen that destroyed some of the best minds of Europe, the best scientists, the best artists, and it really created what, you know, some have called the lost generation, right? People who became nihilists, existentialists, because it was really horrifying what they were put through. But in the context of that, what was the British Empire doing? Well, the inner grand strategists of the empire had created by the 1880s and 1890s two key think tanks that conducted sort of what you might consider a corporate reorganization of the empire. One was called the Fabian Society, that soon created the London School of Economics. That was their sort of school for processing young talent. And the Fabian Society was designed to sort of cater to the left, the downtrodden, the unionists, but it was really, if you look at it, that's who they were catering to as a nominally socialist, you know, operation, but they were managed by people like Beatrice and Sidney Webb, George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, who, when you read their writings of these leading Fabians, they're all super misanthropic. They hate the masses. They only have disdain for the poor. But it's like you're creating now a new movement, a new operation to celebrate the poor and create economic justice. No. There's something else going on here. Who's another one? Mackinder. Mackinder was a leading Fabian as well, who headed the London School of Economics, the founder of modern geopolitics. Also, complete racist. These guys all embraced eugenics as the new science of population control, and even Dalton, who is the founder of this new science, the cousin of Darwin, he was a collaborator with Thomas Huxley, with Huxley's X Club, right? The whole, this Cambridge-based weird Royal Society organization of misanthropic scientists around Huxley, who were trying to repackage and redefine what science is with every branch from sociology to astronomy to mathematics to acoustics to physics. Everything was going to be redefined under this new idea that science is just about mathematical description. It's not about discovering the unknown. It's about using math to describe that which exists. Using your five senses, it's radical empiricism or positivism, as some might call it. This is what people like Dalton were logically, a part of. They were extending this logic into, well, now how do we take these rules and extend it to human social organization, right? How do we now contemplate how to incorporate this into managing the masses and purifying the gene pool, right? Because we could see that things should be getting better, so there's a lot of bad genetics. So how do we clean up the bad genetics by, let's say, finding mathematical or statistical rules that justify the sterilization of the unfit, people whose parents might have been low IQ or had criminal records? They cannot be allowed to procreate if we truly care about, making the world a better place. And so a lot of this stuff even got its funding early on by the Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Foundation. As soon as they were set up, that was some of the earliest initiatives they were backing, including the sterilization laws of Indiana in 1907. So it wasn't a coincidence that this science, the pseudoscience of eugenics, was, as Francis Dalton even said, the basis upon which a new global religion should be based. And Galton has quotes, many quotes, where he said, like, this is the foundation upon which a new religious order must be based, a religion of science. H.G. Wells loved this. He talked about this immensely. And I know you like Bertrand Russell, but I'm so sorry to tell you, Bertrand Russell was the most enthusiastic proponent of this as well. Really, really, really loud. And so the Fabian Society was one of the think tanks that reorganized the empire. The other one was, which interfaced closely with the Fabian Society, it was all based on slow penetration, right? We're going to penetrate and permeate everything we can in every victim country we can to enforce fifth columns, deep states, as we call it today, that will then be able to undermine, target countries and people. Now, the other think tank was set up. It was called the Roundtable Movement, officially created in 1902, and its base of operations was Oxford. The funding for it was primarily Rothschild. Nathaniel Rothschild was a big funder of it, but the money was accrued through the rapacious, ill-begotten gains of Cecil Rhodes, the guy who ran Rhodesia, that created De Beers, right? Much of the current ills of Africa. are found largely in what Rhodes was a part of and created. And he made a fortune, huge lot of money. He also worked very hard with Kitchener and his what's called the Milner Kindergarten, this grouping of sociopathic young men who all have weird proclivities around Lord Milner, who became the head of the Roundtable Movement. They cut their teeth destroying the Transvaal Uprising, right? The Dutch Republican settlers who had been there for hundreds of years and had a very good, healthy relationship with the Zulu people in east South Africa, today South Africa. But that was crushed. They had two Boer wars as part of the Transvaal Republic, and they were ultimately crushed and destroyed by those who created the concentration camp system later on deployed by Hitler. But this was Kitchener, this was Milner's kindergarten, people like Leo Amery, Philip Kerr, who later became a leading player in this process under the Roundtable Movement in America, under the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations. That's what the Roundtable Movement of America was. The creation of the Federal Reserve was set up largely by this clique of sociopaths. And so the Roundtable Movement, people like Milner worked with Mackinder, worked with Beatrice Webb. They were also eugenicists. They were also Malthusians. They were also religiously committed to population control. and the idea of a religion of the British Empire. So how do you create a new type of civil service that you could trust? The old British Empire was a little bit too weak because they said they diagnosed Christianity. the British before the Civil War was still, it's an Anglican society. By virtue of that, it might be absurd that you have the king as your head of your church or queen. That's absurd. But still, you read the Bible. And the tough part for the empire is, well, when you have a bunch of your lords from childhood reading the Bible, and your civil servants, right, that are embedded as governors of India or Ireland or Canada, sometimes they start actually thinking for themselves a little bit, and they think about their conscience, and they think about their souls, and they think about lessons in the Bible, and what happens is that they become untrustworthy, because doing their job becomes harder and harder for them, because their job requires that they commit mass genocide a lot, right? And so they can't sleep at night, and then what they often will end up doing is subverting your own civil service, your own deep state subverts the necessary evil that is required for the maintenance of the empire. And there's tons of cases, even of a British colonial governor in British Columbia who was assassinated because he was trying to work to get British Columbia to join the United States after the Civil War. That was a big point of fight that actually is part of Canada's history. Because there was supposed to be a rail line that would go from Lincoln's Transcontinental all the way through British Columbia into Alaska and into Russia, if you can believe that. It was advancing pretty fast. And so that's a whole thing. So they had the problem of how do you get rid of this conscience, this Christian sort of tradition inside of the British governing class. And so part of the thing about this was eugenics was a great supplement, a great replacement for religion, right? The science of just this cold nihilistic world of randomness, random mutations that govern, the behavior of genetic, fluctuations. The other thing was the Church of the British Empire, right? The idea of processing the young, those who were still too young to think for themselves, but give them scholarships and send them to Oxford, call it Rhodes Scholarships. Do the same thing for the London School of Economics. Process them, look for the best talent, and then redeploy them back after they've been processed into their home countries. So far, I think something like 7,000 Americans have been processed through the Rhodes Scholarship Program, many of whom have played very destructive roles throughout the entire 20th century and today. Like Joe Biden's cabinet is run by Rhodes Scholars today, not just Susan Rice. But I mean, I recently wrote an article, Bruce Reed, Jake Sullivan, Ben O'Malley. There's others that I'm not even thinking about. But this became the thing, right? And the think tanks to coordinate the reorganization of the British Empire under a new name became known later on after was the Council on Foreign Relations, or in Britain it was called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. They had branches in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, which to this very day still exert a huge amount of influence. Hillary Clinton calls the CFR, after all, what she called it, the mothership. That's what she called it in a 2009 speech to the CFR. And sort of the queen of all think tanks. And after World War I, right, when the meat grinder was over, by this time the roundtable movement of Milner and George, what's his name, the prime minister, I'm forgetting his name, but anyway, the roundtable movement took full control of the British government. They ousted the Labour government of Herbert Asquith in 1916 in a bit of a soft coup. They had already ousted an anti-roundtable Canadian government under Wilfrid Laurier in 1911. Wilfrid Laurier, and I write about this in my books, he writes messages after the coup in Canada saying, like, Canada is now fully governed, both parties, by an organization in London called the Roundtable. He understands it. His network comes back into power later on, working closely with Franklin Roosevelt. But once they gain control, what do? They want control, not just to keep the war going, World War I, but they want to control the blueprint for the solution to the war. And this is what we talked about yesterday with Joe Olson, was the League of Nations. So in 1919, you didn't just have the Treaty of Versailles that imposed impossible debt repayments onto Germany that were designed to destroy Germany physically, but also impose hyperinflation, force them to print money that didn't out of thin air to pay unpayable debts with no means of production to justify the debts, resulting foreseeably in the complete destruction. Everyone became a billionaire, but nobody could eat because bread was trillions of dollars, right? That was the process. People were burning money to stay warm. That's sort of like the process. If you want to get the principle of what is shaping our current crisis, it's similar to that. But now it's a little bit more global, or at least concentrated in our transatlantic time bomb area. So they did that, but they also created, and this is the thing, the League of Nations was the key. The covenant of the League of Nations involved not just getting rid of national sovereignty over the military, because the logic was, well, national sovereignty is what created World War One. If we just got rid of national sovereignty and the right of nations to have military, well, we wouldn't have wars anymore and we'd have peace. This is great. And they actually, some people drank that poison, but a lot of people didn't. And that's why it didn't succeed, because the idea was, and that was part of the art, the covenant, like I mentioned yesterday in our interview, Article 10 of the League of Nations covenant was premised around, just like NATO later on, the collective security. If one member of the League gets into a war, everybody is militarily obliged to back them up, and that's a great formula for creating endless wars. So there are many other points that would strip nations of their ability to do anything, which is why the patriotic factions in America around William Harding did a lot of good. And this is not just, he was Republican, but the people who supported him and fought with him to destroy the League of Nations and U.S. involvement in that during the 20s, were Democrat and Republican. There were people, it wasn't a party thing. It was a patriotic thing. Human beings first, who all recognized that they had a common enemy. So you had Canadians as well. You had Irish as well sabotaging this thing. You had Indians. You had Chinese. Sun Yat-sen was vastly outspoken against this, the League of Nations as a sort of solution to our problems. So it failed. That world government agenda failed where it was supposed to have succeeded. And the religion of those promoting the League of Nations, it was, again, a religion of eugenics, of population control. And just to recap a little bit again for those who haven't seen our last show, they tried again. And they tried again in the form of the controlled demolition of the U.S. economy in the 1929 Great Depression. That was completely artificial. The U.S. stock markets were overvalued through broker call loans, like brokers carrying out bets on the market during the deregulated roaring 20s that were deregulated under J.P. Morgan Toole, Calvin Coolidge, and Andrew Mellon, the head of basically the entire, he's the head of the economic czar of America for 12 years. He led a complete British deregulation of the economy, no more protectionism, free-for-all, easy money, a lot of gambling, like economics became more gambling-based. You could increasingly just gamble with people's savings. As long as you were making money, it didn't matter. And the Roaring Twenties was the effect, you know, it was debauchery. The lost generation was made even more confused by this process of hedonism. And I mean, there's things I'm leaving out. You know, you had an organized crime syndicate built up as well under Al Capone and Mayor Lansky and others, utilizing prohibition. But that was an organized creation of a North American Freemasonic-driven organized crime syndicate starting in Canada with the Bronfmans, and then transplanted and grown inside of the USA after Canada got rid of our prohibition and then the US got theirs. But it was a coordinated thing to create this kind of deep state structure of organized crime that would interface with intelligence agencies, that would interface with the FBI, that was used as part of the killing later on of JFK. My wife actually just wrote a wonderful article on that. It's just been published yesterday on the Strategic Culture Foundation. It's really sharp, bringing in the mafia, the Dulles networks, the Gladio operations, into like the what happened in Miami, as well as what was going on in Dallas. Sharp. Anyway, this is all going on in the 20s. And it's different sides of the same thing, right? Those controlling this are not, they're not compartmentalizing these things like we do. We got a problem in our society of compartmentalization, which is why it's difficult to think of whole unifying causal processes, because there's been a war on our minds to keep our minds schismed, right? But this is what they were doing. So the Great Depression was orchestrated. It didn't have to happen. The broker call loans were over, the markets were over, over-evaluated, over-inflated by a factor of something like 8 by 1929. And at a certain day, all of those who were in the know, who were part of the J.P. Morgan, you know, Federal Reserve Network, they basically called in those loans that they extended to the brokers that the brokers couldn't pay, and the brokers defaulted. And what was the foreseeable consequence of this chain reaction default was a deleveraging of the entire economy. The markets collapsed. And you had the biggest wealth transfer in history, right? During this time, those who were in the know, Joe Kennedy, who was part of that that time, unlike his son, he had fewer moral proclivities. And, again, Mellon, Calvin Coolidge, the J.P. Morgan's preferred clients list was a big list of people on the inside who sold short before the blowout. They then used their money to buy up pennies on the dollar, stocks, farms, real estate, infrastructure, for nothing. And they kept it unproductive. It's not like they wanted economic value to happen. They didn't redeploy or revive the industrial base. They kept the industry shut to the point that by 1933 there was only the U.S. had lost 50% of its industrial productive powers. Its machine tool sector was smashed. Farmers, the biggest suicide rates of farmers ever in history. And the agriculture was just being destroyed. Everything was being destroyed. And it was being destroyed for the purpose of creating psychological, spiritual shock therapy so that people would accept as a solution fascism as the economic miracle, which is why Mussolini was Time's Man of the Year, like, you know, God knows how many times. These are the same bankers that created the whole J.P. Morgan network, tried to kill Roosevelt at least twice. Once with a Freemasonic anarchist, Giuseppe Zangara, who was a Freemason, deployed in February of 1933, who tried to shoot Roosevelt. A woman hit his hand in the audience, and he ended up accidentally shooting Mayor Cermak of Chicago. Roosevelt survived that one, but that was a big one. And then later, he was killed before they could even do any investigation. Within weeks, they eliminated Zangara, who was just this low-level disposable idiot. And then you had the bankers' coup, right, with Smedley Butler. And everybody knows the story of Smedley Butler. I don't have to say much, but they basically wanted to take Smedley, you know, who they thought they had under their control. He'd been a tool of the military-industrial complex for 30 years. They thought they still had a handle on him. To take out Roosevelt, install him as a puppet dictator, and use at that time a very fascist-dominated American Legion, which was run by several fascists who openly advocated fascism in America in the 1920s and 30s, and install him as puppet. The thing was, he took names, he played along, and then he blew the whistle to Congress. They had committee hearings. They investigated this. He went to the media. There's films people can watch on YouTube of Smedley Butler speaking to the American people before he dies, going through this banker's plot. So he saved the United States at a key moment of weakness. And it gave Roosevelt the space he needed to, on the one hand, sabotage the banker's dictatorship of 1933. So in London, you had a six-month-long conference in 1932 and 33 called the London Conference. And it was hosted by the Bank of England, the Bank of International Settlements, and the League of Nations. 65 countries were brought on board. It was presided over by the king. And the idea was that the only solution to the Great Depression was to get rid of national sovereignty over economics and give central banks the power to mathematize and regulate world trade and make illegal deficit spending, other things. And it was basically IMF austerity to the wazoo, which would have destroyed nations' abilities to emit the credit needed to develop their infrastructure if that was permitted. So it was, again, it was a banker's dictatorship. And it's completely been written out of the history books. It was part of also the British oligarchical control of gold and gold price commodities was also a big part of this. They were able to keep nations that were tied to gold at that time in a state of disequilibrium, a destabilization, because you could always gamble and speculate on the price of gold. You can contract the gold in circulation if you happen to own a lot of it, and the British Empire and their mining operations were a near vast monopoly. So that was keeping economic warfare going against, especially a USA that was trying to recover. That's a big part of the equation of like why, because people are like, oh yeah, Roosevelt was a bad guy. He illegalized gold. And people who think this. They don't look at this broader role of gold as a weapon of empire to destabilize economically nations. That was a part of it. Roosevelt basically pulled the USA, all of the US delegations, out of all of the meetings at the London Conference of 1933. He refused to allow the US to participate in any of this, and he torpedoed the conference. This is a big part of my volume 2 of the Clash of the Two Americas. So it basically didn't work. And their one world government failed yet again. It was sort of like a great reset. You know, we're going to reset the Great Depression economy that we created as a depression, and we're going to like reset it and create a new system of values for the world under this supranational control. Very similar to the Great Reset. So Roosevelt sabotaged that. And then you had a battle in Britain. Over what would be our technique now to get our New World Order across again. And a big chunk of the British oligarchy, especially around the Roundtable Movement, were saying, let's go with the Hitler card. Let's just put all of our eggs in that basket. Prescott Bush was deployed to bail out Hitler when he was bankrupt. In January of 1933, the Nazi Party lost most of their seats in Parliament. Hitler was contemplating suicide, and who was sent out was Brown Brothers Harriman and Prescott Bush to bail out the Nazi war machine. And the Rockefeller Standard Oil Interests, IG Farben, Union Banking Corporation, the entire JP Morgan Trust, all of these things were immediately putting the majority of their energy into the rise of Mussolini, and especially Hitler, the sponsoring of eugenics science in schools. Rockefeller Foundation was the biggest sponsor of Nazi eugenics policy, Mengele, other things. Same thing for Japan. They were doing the same thing with the Japanese fascists too during this time. The same people that brought us the Federal Reserve, the same people that tried to kill Roosevelt, the same people that funded the banker's coup, the same people that ran they had a think tank, a patriotic think tank that was actually fascist, and I forgot its name. The Liberty League, the 1930s Liberty League that was devoted to keeping the U.S. out of the war, out of World War II, because they had an agreement with the British and the German fascists to carve up the world with an Anglo-American jurisdiction over North America. That's what J.P. Morgan and all of these fascists wanted. That's why they didn't want the U.S. into the war, because they had a previous agreement to have their jurisdiction over the big chunk of the Americas. Britain was going to control India, some of Africa, and some of Europe. Germany was going to control Russia and the heartland. Japan was going to control China, and Manchuria. Mussolini was going to control, they had the whole thing carved out. Franco was going to have chunks of Latin America. So all that to say, there was another design for the New World Order even up to this point. The Nazi king, Edward VIII, was teaching young Elizabeth at this time how to do the Hitler salute. People have seen the videos. And there was a fight within the British oligarchy of, which direction do we go? Hitler, even though Britain was working under Neville Chamberlain overtime to ensure that Hitler was going to grow, was going to gobble up Poland, Austria, Czechoslovakia. That was, again, Czechoslovakia didn't fall. They had the most powerful military in the world. They fell according to British secret diplomacy that got them to fail, and then Hitler was able to absorb their military as well as their gold through the Bank of International Settlements. But the problem was Hitler became less cooperative. He realized at a certain point through his generals that, why are we going to just listen to the British for directions and be their junior partner? Why, we have everything. Why can't we be the leaders and they can be our junior partners? He saved Britain 8 times during the war because he always wanted the Anglo-Saxon pure race to dominate the world together, as Uber mentioned. But some of the British didn't want to go along with that. The British overlords were like, no, we're the captains. You're the bagman. You're the enforcer. We're the captains. And other ones, like King Edward VIII, were more than happy to accommodate Hitler's will. And Edward VIII was writing letters to Hitler the whole time, saying, I'm your man. Put me back in power. I'll be your Nazi king. I promise. And Neville Chamberlain was too. Lord Halifax was too. And ultimately, there was a decision to instead preserve the British Empire, instead put down the Frankenstein monster, which was not obedient anymore. Begged the USA to come in as much as possible. And Roosevelt had a big fight on his hands to both, on the one hand, dismantle the British Empire, but also he describes the Dutch and the French empires and the Belgian empires, and create the basis. And he had meetings with the Russians, with the Chinese, especially with even the Brazilians, around primarily a U.S.-Russia-China alliance that would be the backbone of the new world security economic architecture. And that was the battle, again, of Bretton Woods, of what the world system was going to be. And the British system under John Maynard Keynes, we're told Roosevelt was a Keynesian. Not true at all. Keynes hated Roosevelt. Roosevelt hated Keynes. They both write about that. It's the fact that, because Keynes was a fascist imperialist, a eugenicist to a high degree. And he was representing the British Empire interest to create a one world currency called the Bancor that would have illegalized all other local currencies and had the Bank of England and maintain control of the new world post-World War II currency under an Anglo-American special relationship where the U.S. would be used as the battering ram controlled by British thinkers. So Churchill called it, British brains and American brawn will reconquer the world. Roosevelt had a different idea. His delegation fought against this idea of a one-world Bancor currency. Instead, they had fought for supporting New Deal policies for Africa. I documented again in my book. Look at the Indian, the African, the South American, the Russian delegations with their designs for Tennessee Valley authorities, rural electrification projects in all of Africa, Ghana, India, China, Russia, South America, Brazil. They were all being supported and defended by the American delegation. And it was only the British who were trying to stop everything from happening. Harry Dexter White, who's called a communist agent, ironically, by the Roundtable Movement, who started this myth, was the head of the U.S. delegation. He passed a law. He passed a bill that got voted up to dissolve the Bank of International Settlements at Bretton Woods. It was passed. Everyone voted except for the British to support the dissolution of the Bank of International Settlements and an auditing of the books that would have showcased who really was at the heart of the rise of fascism from the British and American side of things. He died under mysterious circumstances. Roosevelt died under very mysterious circumstances. No autopsy was ever done. But we do know as soon as he died on April 12, 1945, the deep state that he talked about, that he fought against, took over. He spoke to his son, Elliot Roosevelt, about how the State Department is completely controlled by Churchill's people. He was fighting the Rhodes Scholars. The Canadian nationalists, the best elements of them died mysterious deaths in 1941. Odie Skelton, there's four, and the names are escaping me, but they're in my book. We're all fighting against the Roundtable takeover of Canada, and they all died, and the Roundtable took over. To this very day, that's what Chrystia Freeland is. That's what's running the show. That's what has been running the show throughout the entire 20th century. That's what's running Biden. That's what came in with Clinton. That's what ran the entire Cold War. If you want to look at the grand strategists who carried out, who interfaced with Rand Corps, who managed the policies of the Cold War, you got to look at this network. And so this was, nuclear bombs were dropped on a defeated Japan very quickly. The entire Anglo-American special relationship was set up. The OSS was purged, was shut down under Truman, and was purged of all of those patriots in intelligence who understood the Anglo-American alliance behind fascism. Everybody who was allied to Roosevelt's vision of a post-colonial world of cooperation were all ousted. Their careers were destroyed. Some died. Henry Wallace, his vice president, was fired completely. When he was resisting the idea of an Anglo-American fascist government under Truman, he was Commerce Secretary at the time. He was fired. He tried to run for president in 48. That didn't work. The FBI had a lot to do with that. Alan Dulles and that whole network took back controls. And even though you had some pushback here and there with Eisenhower at his better moments, and you had a lot of pushback with Kennedy, despite that, this foreign operation, this sort of London-directed fifth column, took more and more control over every aspect of our lives. And Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were were in a collaborative relationship in 1968. That had to stop, and we can only imagine what the world would have been, right, had it not had Kissinger and the whole Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller complex not taken over, first with Nixon, right, and George Shultz, who worked very closely to break the dollar from the U.S. fixed exchange rate gold standard, or gold reserve, I should say. And that converted the U.S. economy into a consumer society cult. Value became no longer tied to productivity. it became tied to, you know, what can you, how much money can you make with money? How much debt can you create that justifies the monetization of the system, which is tied to ever more speculative rates of, you know, monetary flows out of the deregulated market? And this just became a 50-year process of atrophy. We've destroyed our infrastructure through neglect. We outsourced our industries, our manufacturing have all been outsourced for 50 years consistently, got worse under NAFTA. And this is what Trump tried to reverse by bringing back protectionism, you know, trying to revive the industrial base in a limited way. It required China, though. Like, he that's what his whole U.S.-China trade deal was all about, was, you know, that China has a non-depopulation agenda. If you look at their policies of the Eurasian, of the Belt and Road Initiative, and you look at how that's tied to Russia through the this completely new system of security, economic, finance, it's completely outside of anything we're taught in the West. If you look at it, all of the activity is designed to undo the depopulation and stupidification policy of their people that had been underway for a very long time. So this is what Trump was trying to do, and what he did do to a certain degree with the $350 billion first tier of the U.S.-China trade deal. China was going to buy the U.S. finished goods. That would be the impetus to revive the Rust Belt of Detroit to Philadelphia. He had a program that he passed as an executive order to start an industrial policy of the Arctic by starting with a rail line from the lower 48 states through Alberta into Alaska. That was very much tied to Russia's Arctic development strategies, which is again tied to the Polar Silk Road. That was all undone under Biden and the technocrats. Had the U.S. not been overthrown through this regime change back in 2020, these policies would have continued ahead. The defunding of the World Health Organization by Trump, that was very important. So people might not like it for good reason what Trump says that is. I think he's really stupid on the whole vaccine thing. I think he's dumb. I think it's a big blind spot. But at the same time, if you shut down the U.S. connection to the World Health Organization, on the one hand, that creates a big precedent for other countries to do the same, which would happen very quickly. Number two, all of the dictatorial medical dictatorship stuff could not happen, right? So it doesn't matter that you got vaccines floating around. You don't have a policy to create a medical dictatorship. And there's so many more things. But this was what was being revived, and this is the only viable thing in the U.S. When I look at the U.S. at this point, the only viable, if the U.S. is going to avoid a dark age, a complete meltdown, it's because there is something within that more viable component of the Republican Party that is capable of organizing itself properly, learning from its mistakes. Will that be Trump who leads it or somebody else? I don't know. I think Trump still has potential. He certainly has a willingness to fight. I think he's got blind spots, but despite that, I don't see many other people who are capable of wielding that level of influence at this time of crisis. So that's one thing. But I think he needs to have a very educated base who's able to, like, think for themselves and not fall for these, like, stupid traps, you know, in the intellectual minefield that try to say that, oh, all of our problems are caused by evil China or evil Russia or evil Venezuela or something stupid, right, that just completely avoids this entire, you know, continuity of this satanic oligarchical system built that's been built into the black nobility of Europe concentrated in the city of London that's been there for a long time. People are just avoiding looking at that. Because I don't know, there's a variety of reasons maybe why. But all that to say, that's where we're at right now. I know we're running out of the end of our second hour, so I figured I would probably wrap it up here.
No, I want more about how we can evade the New World Order, the Great Reset. And I want to bring you back. I will discuss this with you, Matt, as soon as we conclude the show. But I want you to address that issue.
Sure. I mean, the key thing, like I said, is to look at what worked in the past. Like, people really need to get studious at this point. There's a lot of fake narratives about the past, about Lincoln, about Roosevelt, about the U.S. Revolution, about everything. But I think looking at firsthand material, looking at how did the oligarchy, how did the New World Order, how was it thwarted? What did Roosevelt do for his war on Wall Street, the breaking up of the banks? How are too big to fail banks broken up? Because we never did that. How did he throw hundreds of bankers into prison for manipulating the bubbles of before the Great Depression? Hundreds of bankers went to prison under the Pecora Commission. We don't know about that. If we don't know about that, we can't expect anything. We can't fight for anything that would allow that to work again. How did Lincoln
admit the non-existent credit that was needed to build up the industrial base of the USA or the Transcontinental Railway through the 520 bonds or the greenbacks. How did that work, right? How did the U.S. survive its first 15 years when it was easily going to be reconquered economically by the British in the 1780s? The U.S. was a basket case. It couldn't pay its debts. It had no industry. It had no infrastructure to speak of. It was just an agrarian society that was dying, drowning in unpayable debts incurred during the Revolutionary War. So how did that change? Why didn't it get, you know, every state, every one of the 13 states were fighting amongst themselves. There was no free trade amongst the states. There was no means of collecting taxes or import duties. That couldn't be done. It was a nation divided against itself. So how did the U.S. survive? How did that replicate itself in the case of, I'm asking questions because it's through, really let these questions sink in. I'm talking to the audience here, right? But people have to let these questions really take fertile soil and pursue answering them, really, because they're paradoxical. You can resolve the paradoxes. How did this take root in Germany to unify the German state under Friedrich List and Bismarck, such that the Marxist anarchist type of system was deployed to destroy and subvert that positive trajectory? Why, you know? So how did this thing work in the past? How is Russia, look at Russia and China's policies. Like a lot of people, they want to get third party experts to tell them what to think about China or Russia. They want to, how do I feel? How do I think? Let me find this voice that's going to teach me how to think, rather than just looking themselves at like, well, what are Russia and China doing? Can I read the writings or the speeches, the transcripts of Xi Jinping, of Putin, of Modi? Yeah, I can do that, but it takes work. You know, you're not going to get it if you just expect it to be spoon-fed to us from third-party analysts in the West, right? Whether CNN, whether Fox, whether even alternative media, whether Epoch Times, you won't get a big chunk of context. So look at what they're doing. What are the policies? How are they funding it? How has China been able to utilize state national banking that it never permitted to be privatized, but whereas we did? But they can do that. They can build like 40,000 kilometers of high-speed rail in 20 years. We have zero in Canada. I think the U.S. is maybe, what, 100 kilometers or something tiny? We can't do anything, whereas they can. Is it because they have a magic wand? No, they're using principles of economic practice that used to be American. That's how America built up. That's how they quadrupled their population between 1780 and 1820. America's population grew by fourfold. Its productive powers grew exponentially. It outproduced the Britain in steel and many other things by doing the sorts of things that China is doing in principle today with increasingly Russia, which is hopefully now finally breaking free of its fifth columns that manage still to this very day its privatized central bank, who are run by the IMF. But there's a big fight in Russia regarding that, too. So, you know, that I would say, look at what your enemy is afraid of. Look at what has worked in the past to destroy your enemy, and then do more of that. And that's I think, the biggest piece of advice I would tell anybody is do what your enemy is afraid of. And if there is a fight currently underway, the only viable fight against the depopulation agenda for world government that I see anywhere on the earth today that is viable, the thing that scares the oligarchy, is what's coming out of Eurasia. That's where the big fight is on. In the West, our countries have become, you know, kind of basket cases. You know, the Nazis that we thought that were defeated were the same operatives that took back control starting in 1946. You know, and it's only gotten worse after JFK was killed. There's a little video on YouTube, you know, that's gone viral. It's a British, you know, skit comedy with these like two British guys dressed as like Nazis, like pretending that they're fighting the Russians in World War II with their Nazi regalia, and they're like, "Wait, why do we have like stalls on our hats and our uniforms? Isn't that a little bit morbid?" And they finally come to a dialectical conclusion that actually they're the baddies in this war. They thought they were the good guys, and I think we have to come to that humble moment. We recognize the evil that we've permitted to take over our society, and then with that humility, recognize where the fight is currently waged such that we can interface positively the way Trump was doing by, you know, moving the U.S. into a cooperative relationship with Russia, with China, with other countries that wanted development, that would benefit the U.S. on every level. The people, the industrial base, even the rich would benefit, would make a lot of money building infrastructure, you know, building new scientific and technological projects in Africa with China working side by side with us. Holy shit, he could make so much money developing the Arctic. Huge untapped potential. So that's what's been undermined with Biden and this whole, you know, zero growth, anti-growth, new religion of transhumanism that's coming online with him. But the first thing that I think is understanding, like, action is relatively easy, but it could become messy if you don't have, if you haven't done the mind work to properly understand the topography, you know, the invisible topography of what you're operating on, which it's, you know, this is, we've got cultural historic forces at play, that we have to understand to a certain degree if we're going to navigate through it and be effective at this battle. Otherwise, good-hearted people can be inclined or induced to participate in a civil war on behalf of their enemies who they think that they're fighting, but they actually aren't. That's part of the British plan currently, is to create, you know, to create a radicalization out of economic despair that's going to get worse in the American people and Europeans, who will then want to destroy out of despair. They'll become radicalized. It's already beginning. And that will justify the whole domestic terror policy that Biden has put through to say, oh, yeah, look, anybody who supports Trump or who is a conspiracy theorist, they're domestic terrorists. It's like, that's a lie. But at the same time, we could accidentally end up playing into it the way so many good people have in history, you know. So that's a danger. We don't want to misstep there either.
Oh, Matt, this is just spectacular. I have to have you back. I hope as early as Monday. You tell me.
It's a crazy week.
Or Wednesday.
Our schedule and let's
yeah, we'll talk. Just for the benefit of the audience, there are no higher intellects on the face of Earth today. I'll just tell you, this is one you're going to want to listen to again and again. This guy is just perfect. And I just say, as I've sought to emphasize myself in the past, we have to understand the situation we are in order to know what action we might take that would be constructive in accomplishing our goals. So we are of one mind, kindred spirits in the search for truth. And Matt brings vast resources, historical, that I judge to be highly complimentary to my philosophical and scientific. I encourage everyone, spend as much time as you can with your family. We do not know how much time we have left. We have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to have Matt back on Monday, if not later in the week. Have a great weekend, and thank you for joining us today.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me death!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and